meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning into The Winds of Change. It's Wednesday, and that means that Father Coyes is here. Father Tom Coyes, happy to be with you to share some brain-wrinkling lessons, especially from history.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
There we are. Now we didn't wrinkle it yet, but we just started the show, but that's an anticipation. And we will open your mind to the beauty and glory. And that's the reward room as opposed to the punishment room. We haven't used the punishment room in a while, Nick. It's because we've been so good and we've been very professional here at Great Winds of Change Radio here on AM 750. So those who get my little flock notes perhaps saw that the topic today will be football and Emperor Charles V. Now, as is my custom, I like to touch on the topics of the day as well as topics of other days. See, because there's a great unity as you look at human history, and we can learn from the past to know about what's today. Oh, there you go. Yes, hello,
hello
Mr.
there,
Peabody.
Peabody here.
Good to see you.
Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
Well, let's just say the 16th century, because we're going to jump all over the 1500s there. And Emperor Charles V was in that time. You may realize that there's a 500th anniversary coming that is technically, or so to speak, of the Reformation, or like I like to call it, the so-called Reformation, or the rebellion that split the church. G.K. Chesterton and C.S. Lewis, I think, also calls it the Great Divorce, where the marriage, the church was split. And that's a good place to start, because though there were important reforms, it's kind of like saying if two people are married and you do divorce and each person changes for the better and gets married to new people, right? Husband and wife are having trouble. They go through marriage counseling. They're trying to reform their lives and change their lives for the better. But it can't happen, and the husband and wife divorce. And of course, we all know people that have gone through that. Perhaps you who are listening yourself has gone through that. It's very challenging. It's very sad, a very difficult thing, but part of life. And we have to get through it, right? We have to know. I do believe Catholic Church has really the best answer to it all, because with divorce and remarriage comes something called an annulment. And I do believe annulments are a great moment of grace where people can and should, we say have to, look back on the past and learn from the past so that a new subsequent marriage can be built on a more firm foundation, as it were. And that's a very good thing. But it would be a little strange to call when the two people get remarried then to two new people. It would be a little bit of a misuse of language to say that the first marriage was reformed. You reformed your marriage. Well, no, you didn't reform the marriage. You reformed your life and started a new marriage. So that's why when going back into that part of the history, it's good to see the ambiguity of the term reformation. But before I get to that, and we're going to come back around, all things come around together, as good thinkers often see. I can't help but begin the show a bit with my two cents in the conflict du jour, the conflict of the day, which everyone is focused on, is the taking the knee at the singing of the national anthem. It's something that I have to confess gets under my skin, and I'm going to use a family analogy, because family language, family ideas are universal. We should all meditate on the meaning of family, and it fits this issue. I'm going to bring this into play in the taking the knee at the national anthem, because it is ultimately a family problem. If we can look at it as a family problem, I think we can advance through it a little bit better. What I mean by that is there's some people who are upset at the family, and that the nation, there's anger and disappointment at how our nation is existing, and especially it's focused on the issue of racism. I have to say it seems to be exaggerated that there is racism. I think no one's denying, but that it rises to a level that borders on the rejection of the family. Here's what I want you to put into context, my friends. If you could listen with your eyes and remember a sculpture that I've talked about here and there throughout my time here at Winds of Change, and as a matter of fact, I've even brought it in here once to the radio to show Tony and the rest of the gang. It's a sculpture of seven circles that hang from one source. They hang from a hook on the top that represents the individual's covenant to God. And the circles underneath that one hook get bigger and bigger, because each of the circles represents the covenants, a familial covenant that we have in our lives that are universal and that affect us all. But it's when taken as a whole, is a tremendous symbol of the church. It's a symbol of how I look at my faith and the Catholic Church, because it all begins with a personal relationship, me and God. And from that personal relationship with me and God comes often a spousal relationship, a spousal covenant, which we call a marriage. And so the next level of bonding, shall we say, the bonding at the top of the sculpture is our individual bonding with God, me and God. And God is very happy that we are bonded with him. And of course, atheists would say there's no such thing and you cannot bond with God. Even people who believe in God, there are many religions who don't believe there is a relationship between the individual and God, or at least not a loving relationship. There may be a relationship of master and slave, which is more the Eastern philosophical underpinnings of Eastern religions like Islam. You do have a relationship, but it's not father to son, it's master to slave. But from that individual bond flows, you look for another bond with a human being, and that's what we call marriage. From that bond, children arrive, and then we have what we call the biological family, and that is a family, no doubt. And the bonds between brothers and sisters and mother and child and father and child are a part of most of our lives. Then there is the extended family, and that is also a form of a family. And you can see how that gets bigger. And then, of course, that includes cousins and aunts and uncles and children of a mother and a father obviously have four grandparents, and then there's those. So the concept of family is a beautiful one, but it's not as static. It's not as easy as we might think of it. It's a powerful concept that pushes us to further bonds, to further covenantal relationships with these other people in our lives. And when groups of families get together, if there's groups of extended family, you get what is kind of known in the Bible as the tribe, which is made famous in the Bible, in the Old Testament, with the 12 tribes of Israel. You can well imagine that the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Benjamin, the tribe of Asher and Dan and Issachar and all those were groups of extended families, many households, as the wonderful Scott Hahn likes to put it. And I think it's so beautiful. So what I'm getting at is, as you go down this concept of family, there. You get to the nation. You bring together a bunch of tribes, which is what happened in the Bible under Moses. Moses became the head of the 12 tribes, and the nation of Israel is kind of born, or it grows out of an attempt to unify the 12 tribes. And that being done, there is need for new covenantal relations, new rules, new leaders, as it were. And then, of course, when you step back even farther, then you see other nations are doing the same thing. And so how do you unite and look at international relationships, and new rules and new leaders have to arise. This is where I started thinking about Emperor Charles V. He was one of the famous emperors during the time of the Protestant rebellion, as it were. He was emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, which I'm going to try to convince you in this little time that we have here on Winds of Change. Are you ready for a brain wrinkling of all brain wrinklings? Well, I hope you are, because... Yes, that is the approval of the masses. Thank you, Nick. That was very good. I'm going to try to prove to you or show to you that the Holy Roman Empire in Europe was the seeds of the United States of America. Now, that would shock most people, but I think a good case could be made. Because the Holy Roman Empire was the only people trying to unite a bunch of states together, which in the European sense of the word state is what we kind of think of as nations. How do you unite a bunch of little nations together under the Holy Roman Empire or into an empire. So the very concept, the very ideology that spawned the United States of America is the same ideology that spawned the Holy Roman Empire, an attempt to unify groups of smaller entities. Over here, we call them the states. And actually, in Europe, they were called states, too, and then they became nations. So anyways, how does this relate to the football and the taking of the knee? I gotta explain to you that. Let me. I had to set the scene, and I'm going to explain to you why this vision, this, the picture I'm trying to paint with my words here, it will help us through the difficult time of the taking of the knees that we're getting and the incredible conflicts that are arising. So thank you for listening. Stay tuned, my friends. You are listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
On Saturday, October 7th at 1 p.m., choose love, choose life, and join in the 5th annual Northwest Families March for Life, beginning at St. Teresa Church, 455 North Benton in Palatine. Join the march to be inspired and energized. All faiths are welcome to gather. Teens from Crusaders for Life will lead the march with their energetic drumming and singing, with life-affirming signs to share the love of life. Hear Joe Scheidler of the Pro-Life Action League. Additional speakers include Bishop Brassus, plus Save the Storks Mobile Ultrasound Initiative, and David Smith will educate marchers on how to respond with love and truth to the anti-life arguments for abortion and assisted suicide. After the march, back at St. Teresa, there will be a reception. For complete details, visit northwestfamiliesforlife.weebly.com. That's northwestfamiliesforlife.weebly, spelled W-E-E-B-L-Y.com. Come to the Northwest Families March for Life, Saturday, October 7th at 1 p.m. St. Teresa Church, 455 North Benton in Palatine. Choose love. Choose life.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
Hey, welcome everyone. Father Tom Coyce here on The Winds of Change. Happy to be with you. I'm trying to set up
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Well, I hope I did the last comment. I got to come back to explain how I mean the Holy Roman Empire was a prefiguration of the United States of America. That wrinkles a lot of people's brains, but it's an insight that is coming straight from the beyond. I believe the Holy Spirit is guiding me in sharing this with you. But we're talking about the football players and the sign of protest. There are some of us who are trying to use the Jedi mind trick, you know, the great Jedi mind trick, which is happens with the in Star Wars with Obi-Wan Kenobi. And there is a way to bend someone's thinking, as it were. And I'm going to say, when I see those football players kneeling down, this is the Jedi
you
mind
trick. You don't need to see his identification.
We don't need to see his identification.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for.
You can go on your way.
You can go about his business.
Oh, you can.
You can go about your business.
Move along.
Move along.
Move along. Move along.
You see, when powerful minds are connected to weaker minds, this is the theory of the Jedi mind trick. Man who has a powerful mind can bend the thoughts of the man with the weaker mind. Now, can't say that every stormtrooper is a weak-minded guy. However, this is what happens, and I'm going to use my master. I studied under Yoda as well, as a matter of fact, when I was in philosophy school. So I know some of the secrets of the Jedi Knights. And so what I'm going to suggest, when we see the people kneeling at the national anthem, I'm going to say, look at those people praying to Almighty God that he bless this wonderful nation of ours. They are so tuned into Almighty God that they fall on their knees in prayer. So I'm going to pretend that they are praying, and I'm going to use my Jedi mind tricks to get them to pray. Maybe if they are weak of mind, they will start to pray. And it is in connecting to God that we find our hope in our healing of the wounds. Yeah, the terrible, unfortunate marriage between the ones who want to heal wounds of racism, they've hooked their cause to the secular bandwagon. Those who think that Christianity especially is sort of the enemy. So the more secular you become, the less connected to God you are, the less racism will affect our society. That's the great mistake that they're making. And what happens in my mind is that even if someone is not happy with what's going on in the family, you don't diss the family name, as it were. If you're, and like I say, the belonging to a nation is just a consequence of belonging to families. That's why I spent so much time before the first break explaining the level of covenants, the level of familial bonds, the level of interpersonal relationships that we have. And they are hierarchical. They are hierarchical in the sense that they have to, you have to put your marriage first, even before your children. You have to put your children first before your neighbor's children or the cousins. And you have to put your town first before you put the next town first. And can you see where I'm going with this? That's what ties into what I gotta confess that it ties into even what President Trump says when he says, I'm gonna put America first, when he's speaking in terms of how do you try to help your family in relationship to other families, him being the leader of the nation then, he's the head of the household called the nation, and when there's conflicts with other nations, he's going to put his family first. And that is very similar to a father putting his children first before he puts his neighbor's children. Does that mean you don't look out for your neighbor's children? By no means. Does that mean you despise or treat your neighbor's children unfairly? By no means. But it means you show your greatest love toward your own children, and that sense of a national family, the ones who, if my Jedi mind trick does not work, if these people are not really praying and they are not sincerely trying to connect to God, if they are just showing a great disdain for their family, then they are more in the realm of the rebellious teenager, as opposed to the faithful spouse that's maybe realizing that there's problems in the family, but we're going to deal with them the best we can with the help of God. And so I just sense that the disdain for the national identity flows from a disdain and a breakdown of the smaller families. I think that there is, when your family is dysfunctional, when your personal biological family is dysfunctional and you've had so many people leaving, disowning, there's so many starting over again, unfaithfulness and all the rest, then it's all the more difficult to have a optimistic, positive sense of the national family. And the national family helps heal when you have dysfunctionality within your biological families and your blood families, we'll call them. The sense that there is a pride and an identity with a national family gets you through and heals you as well. And you don't see us Catholics, we appreciate each of these levels. And we're willing to say, oh my goodness, yes, look at the sins of the family, but it's my family, and I'm going to stick with it one way or another. And I'll hopefully, you got to say, with the help of God, we're going to do our best to heal what has caused those divisions. And but a Catholic mind then doesn't stop at the national identity. There is an identity that goes beyond nationalism that Catholicism ties into, because Catholicism, that Greek word meaning universality, wants us to have an identity that goes beyond our nationalism but doesn't diss our nationalism. That's what I see in so many secularists and, shall we call them, leftists today, is that there is a disdain for a national identity, but they don't have an identity that goes beyond, or if they do, which is sometimes referred to as, I'm a global citizen, or I'm a citizen of the world. That sounds very nice. But that membership as a citizen of the world, you don't have to pay taxes to, and you don't have to vote or listen to the leaders. If maybe it doesn't even have leaders, it doesn't have rules like your national family has laws that have to be obeyed, and that legislation happens. There's no, if you're a citizen of the world, there's no world leader. That's I think a good thing, because you would find similar problems that you have in the smaller national leaders, and this is a good segue into my second topic of today. That is Emperor Charles V. I've recently fallen in love, but I've recently found a new hero. And this is going to sound funny, but Emperor Charles V reminds me of our president today, in that he's certainly not, nobody who looks at history and goes back to the 16th century, the time of the Protestant Reformation, will say of Emperor Charles V that he was a stellar moral tower. He fumbled in different ways. But his actions and his speeches and his words were so often beautiful and enlightening. To Emperor Charles V, just to put you in the context here, he was elected, when was he elected? I believe he was elected in 1500. Is that what my notes are going to say here? He became emperor. Oh my goodness, I don't have it. Let me give you his little bio here. He was the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, as well as king of Castile. Here's a good example of the nation of Spain was not yet the nation of Spain. It was kingdoms, and one of the kingdoms was called Castile, so it needed a king. What's interesting about Emperor Charles V is that his father was Emperor Maximilian, who was the emperor before Charles IV. And there was an emperor in between there, I believe. But anyways, he was a Catholic, and he was trained by a wonderful priest and also a wonderful woman. The woman was Margaret Habsburg, who went through a lot of suffering because Charles V's own mother, one by the name of Juana, for a number of reasons, and maybe just medical reasons, she was actually locked up in the Tower of Torrecillas in Spain as a lunatic. And so poor little Charles, his father died when he was 9, and his mother was put in a lunatic asylum. And so the future emperor was raised by his aunt, Margaret, who was the sister of Emperor Maximilian. And poor Margaret, you could see how her suffering brought her wisdom. Her first husband, Prince Juan of Spain, died 6 months after their marriage. Can you see that? I have a goddaughter for whom that same thing happened, and it just is a devastating, terrible difficulty to endure. So, but being a royal person, she had all the comforts of the royal house, but her heart was rendered asunder, shall we say. She had great suffering. She marries again, and her second husband dies when he's only 25 years old. So she's a widower after two husbands at a fairly young age. She becomes the perfect godmother of Emperor Charles, the future Emperor Charles V. And one of the tutors, she gets a Father Adrian Dedel to be his tutor. Father Adrian Dedel becomes Pope Adrian. Amazingly, he's only Pope for a very short time because he dies suddenly. But a beautiful thing that this ties into my issue of the Holy Roman Empire being a prefiguration of the United States. It shows, notice Emperor Charles V was born in what is today Germany. So he was fluent in German and then becomes king of Castile in Spain. So he has to go to Spain as a non-Spanish speaking German. Okay, but because he had the Catholic ideology, I'll just call it that, because he had the Catholic instinct of knowing that an identity belonging to the church gave you an identity that goes beyond national identity, he was able to be a German-speaking Lutheran. He wasn't Lutheran. He fought the Lutheran Reformation. That's what's going to come up. But because he was a German-speaking, I can't call him a German because Germany didn't exist yet. In what was to become Germany, born in Flanders, he was able to be a good he was able to embrace the Spaniards as well as the Germans. And that doesn't come easily. That's the thing we gotta appreciate, my friends. It doesn't come easily. And yet, because he had these two wonderful, holy, wise tutors that were kind of his godmother and godfather, the great Margaret of Habsburg and the future Pope Adrian, they gave him that sense of the rightness of the extended family that is the family of God, because we call God our Father. So if God is the Father, who are going to be his children? Can you say that only the Germans are God's children? No, you don't want to say that. Can you say the Spaniards are only God's children? No, you don't want to say that. How about the English? No, which points to the great error of the Reformation leaders, like Queen Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen, we put in quotes because she wasn't a virgin, but she was called the Virgin Queen. One of her handlers, one of her right-hand mans, we'll get to this guy, Archbishop Cranmer, he coined the phrase the Virgin Queen along with the phrase Bloody Mary, who was the Catholic queen right before Queen Elizabeth. And because Queen Mary was trying to reestablish Catholicism in England, she had some executions. So Archbishop Cranmer, he's a master of the media, and he got the nomenclature Bloody Mary. I'm not much of a drinker, and I don't do bartending very much, but I would love to come up with a drink called the Bloody Elizabeth. So because Queen Elizabeth had many more people executed than Queen Mary ever did. So let's, I got to weave this back together again, but let's take another quick break. Don't go away. I'm filling your brains with some important knowledge. And so take notes if you can. And we'll be right back. I'm Father Tom Coy, sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, where you can enter into the presence of Christ 24/7. Every first Saturday afternoon will be a special opportunity for healing. At 4:30, bring your petitions for our Blessed Mother's intercession as we pray the Rosary. Then, at 5, we share the body of Christ in the Holy Mass, followed by a Eucharistic procession, adoration, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and an anointing. Enter into the sacred space of St. Stanislaus Kostka and place yourself before Christ for healing. On first Saturday afternoon, starting at 4:30, find St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, 2 blocks north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy in Chicago, and find peace and healing.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
St. Stanislaus Kostka's 150th anniversary dinner at the Union League Club of Chicago for Sunday, October 22nd, has been canceled, but will be rescheduled. Please listen to Winds of Change and also visit ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org for the new day and date for the St. Stanislaus Kostka's 150th anniversary dinner.
Hey, there we go. Nice to be back with you. God bless you for being with me. I'm trying to do a little history lesson here. And I thought I should. Every time I do a show like this or bring up this topic, I need to do a warning. And that is like, I do have, it's a warning.
Danger,
and it's
Will Robinson.
Yeah, there we
danger.
Go.
Danger, no, Will Robinson. Danger.
There is a danger in these topics. I'm telling you the truth. I'm not making these points up about the Reformation, but the danger is, just like in family life, when you learn some of the bad that went on in the past of the family, it gives you ammunition today, as it were. And sometimes people use that ammunition in ways that can be very destructive. That is to say, I want to review the history of the Reformation, but I need to ask you, with my listener, to be careful in the sense that, like with any family story, learning some of the bad things about the past can get you very angry, there is a virtue. Let me say this. There is a certain virtue in forgetting. there's a certain vice in forgetting, right? When we say, we'll never forget 9/11, and I think that's kind of happening. It's amazing that some of the young people, even in our teen club and high schools and colleges now, don't remember 9/11. And so the tendency to not talk about it has brought about an ignorance of the facts, and especially the fact being that the 9/11 was carried out by Islamic terrorists is forgotten, or it's not taught. If it's not taught, it becomes forgotten. So there's a certain virtue in remembering, but there's also a virtue in forgetting, as long as the right lessons are learned and we don't repeat the same mistakes. And that's unfortunately the danger that can easily be seen if we do forget the real lessons of 9/11. And the same thing can be said of many things of history. We have, as a body, forgotten the bad things of the past associated with the Reformation. And to that extent, it can be virtuous, because then we'll go along and try to build on more positive pathway, shall we say. That's good. But as I say, if we don't learn from the mistakes and build on them, we'll just repeat the mistakes. And that's why I do think it's important for me to share some of the story of the Protestant Reformation, and because some of the facts are hidden, and the wrong impression can be the wrong lessons, the wrong doctrines, the wrong beliefs. Especially as a Catholic person, I'm particularly sensitive to the misreading or the wrong blaming on the Catholic shoulders, as it were. And as a basically Protestant nation in the United States, that's an interpretation that is quite often exhibited when it's touched upon, and if it's not touched upon, then the wrong assumptions become hidden, but they're still just as real. Does that make any sense to you? I hope it does, my friends. So let that be my warning. Let that be my advice as we go into some of the details. Here's one of the details that I think any study of the Reformation needs to start with. And I start with it as the Catholic side, because it's going to put the Catholic side in the bad light. And that is that there were some not so holy, not so wise, not so prudent leaders in the church from the Pope on down. The Pope, Cardinal, bishops, priests. One of the so-called bad popes was Pope Clement V. He imposed very high taxes and openly gave land to supporters and family members. It was one of the very real issues that you got to remember at this time was that the Pope had control of a lot of estates. They're called the papal estates, and they were pretty big, and they were in as big as many of the other states that were run by kings or other noblemen. And so the popes, very unfortunately at this time, let their worries about their lands get the best of them, and they abandon theology and morality for holding on to their lands. So when you study and you see some of the, when Martin Luther says there are a lot of bad popes, I'm going to say as a Catholic, I'm a Catholic who believes in Catholicism, that he's right. They weren't the Antichrist, is what Luther came to call them. And they were weak or imprudent, even immoral at times. And yet they were a principle of unity, but unity around what? The unity around the truth of the faith. And that's where Emperor Charles V comes in as I think, a great hero of the time. When Martin Luther was claiming that there were no seven sacraments and that the Pope and the papacy were the Antichrist. Here, let's go to one of the famous debates between Martin Luther and a priest by the name of John Eck. There was a debate. This was in the context of the Council of Worms, or what's called the Diet of Worms. The word diet is so funny, because a diet of worms seems like you're going to have a plate of squiggly worms that you're going to eat. But the word diet is kind of like a word for a parliament, and Worms is just the name of a town in what is now Germany. So it's the parliament of the town in of Worms. And so during that council, during that parliamentary proceedings, which was called by Emperor Charles V, Emperor Charles V was much more attuned to what was going on in the Holy Roman Empire than the Pope was, being the leader, the civil leader of the Holy Roman Empire. He knew that there was turmoil brewing and there were fights arising. And so the Emperor Charles V calls the Diet of Worms, and he calls on the Pope to call a church council. So the Diet of Worms was like a conference called by the emperor, civil magistrate, of course. And in the process, he's saying, hey, Pope, we need to reform this church. And the great sadness of history is that the Pope refused to call the council. At times he tries a little bit, but doesn't get into it. It reminds me, I don't like saying this, but it reminds me a bit of the cardinals who are today trying to ask our Pope Francis to clarify some of the ambiguities about the faith that are associated with his apostolic letter. And the Pope at the time, Pope Leo X, was being asked by the emperor, let's have an ecumenical council to clarify some of these theological issues that Martin Luther and John Calvin and the rest were bringing up. And they needed to institute some official reforms, get things clear. But it wasn't happening. And unfortunately, the Pope at the time was anti-Charles V. Why? Because of land and because of the smooth working of the French hierarchy and the French kings. See, there was a battle going on between what is now Northern Italy. They were officially the papal states, okay, we got that. But then the way tribes and royal noble families would fight over their territory, France, the King of France, I think it was Henry II at the time, wanted to make that area of northern France part of that area of northern Italy is part of northern southern France. And the Spanish wanted to make that area of northern Italy part of northern Spain. So that was going on. And the Pope was too interested in maintaining that land and being friends with France, because it saw that France was going to help them maintain that land better than the emperor, than the emperor or Spain. Now, the emperor happened to be a king in Spain, but he was more the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, which was basically more up north where Germany is. Okay, are you following me? So, because the Pope was just more trying to be politically correct and worrying about his land, he sided with the French. And in some of the battles, here's the emperor saying, let's have an ecumenical council. We got to listen to this Martin Luther. We got to give him answers. Not that we have to listen to him, that he's a great reformer, but that he's bringing up all these questions that need to be answered. Emperor Charles V, actually, because he had such great tutoring, defended not only the seven sacraments, which Martin Luther was dismantling, and do I have to add this? I think maybe I do. Marriage is one of them. And here we go in the modern world today. What is the battle so strongly over today? What is marriage? Well, if marriage is not a sacrament, then how do you stand on the idea that God wants marriage to be between a man and a woman? What do you do when there's infidelity and remarriage and all the rest? So, but the emperor not only defended the seven sacraments, but he also defended the divine origin of the Catholic Church and the divine mission of the Petrine office. So the emperor was one of the greatest defenders of the Pope in terms of teaching about the nature of the papacy, but the Pope was fighting against the emperor because he was worried about the land, and he didn't even really think he didn't think that the Protestant Reformation was all that important. So much so that when it came to fighting the Spanish army or the army of the Holy Roman Empire, when they were fighting over Milan and Naples and all those areas of northern Italy, the Pope went along with the French king who asks for and receives Protestant, the new Lutheran / new Protestant soldiers who were fighting the Catholics up in northern Europe in the area of Germany. And so the French king says, hey, we got to beat Charles V. And so he sends out an invitation. I need warriors. I need soldiers. So he gets them from the Protestant fighters, as well as, and you got to remember how complicated and how treacherous this time of history was. This was the time when the Muslims were on the march. We're kind of done with the Crusades, and so the Middle East is kind of solidly in the hands of the Muslims, and now they're marching north. And so the King of France asks for help from the Muslim soldiers. Why? In order to win the battle over the northern Italy states. Here's Emperor Charles V, and he's saying, we can't go along with, we don't want Muslims, we got to watch out for the Muslims attacking Europe. And the Pope, to his great shame, didn't care. He went along with the king, the French king, to include some Muslim warriors as well as Protestant soldiers in the battle over the northern Italian states. At one point in the history of the back and forthness of those papal states, Emperor Charles V says, all right, France, you can have the northern Italian states. We won't fight with you, but let's make a treaty, and let's have one of my daughters or granddaughters, I forget which it was, marry one of your sons to be king and queen over that area. And even that didn't satisfy the king of France. So you could see, Emperor Charles V, he reminds me somewhat of our present president. Not that Trump is Catholic, of course, and Trump is not going to defend the seven sacraments, but he's defending the conservative approach to marriage, even though, obviously, his own personal life had some ups and downs with marriage. It's so beautiful that his wife now is a Catholic woman. Maybe the last is the best. he saved the best for the last. I like to think so. And by virtue of that, trying to support those who are promoting a more conservative moral stand on things, he comes off very much like Charles V. Even the fact that Pope Francis has criticized him in his promise to build the wall, which is basically a desire to hone in the identity of the United States of America. He's realizing, along with many people, that are the identity of what it means to be an American in the United States is becoming more and more ambiguous. It's becoming, shall we say, only identified with the virtue of tolerance of a more liberal, progressive, moral stand, especially regarding the family. I might note, do I need to point this out, that what I'm seeing in the world today here in our own backyard seems to be a fulfillment of the Fatima promises. If you remember, we're in the 100th year of the apparitions of Our Lady of Fatima, and one of the things that Our Lady said was that the final test or the final battle is going to be over the family. And it's certainly happening. And she also said that there would be conflicts between leaders in the church. And the fact that there's such battles and division between leaders in the church is fulfilling the words of Mary at Fatima. And so I could see, you know, the more you look at history, the more you see history tends to repeat itself. And the fact that Pope Francis has criticized Trump in some ways is reminiscent of the way Pope Leo X criticized Emperor Charles V. So I imagine I wrinkled your brain a little bit here today. I hope we've got to come back to this further. And make sure when you tune into the Winds of Change on Wednesdays that you bring your little notepad, because it's only going to get more complicated. But it's beautiful, and it's part of our life, and it makes our faith stronger. I'm Father Tom Coyce. I'm sitting in for Father Anthony Boyce. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time.